From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in the year 79 AD near Mount Vesuvius, and you probably know the story of Pompeii, the buried city, the victims literally preserved at their moment of death when the ash covered the town. But I'd like to direct your attention to a smaller town just a bit to the northwest, closer to the volcano itself. It was called Herculaneum, and it too was buried. In the 1700s, someone was digging a well and found a statue, and that sparked an excavation as crews dug rudimentary tunnels to discover what might be hiding below the ground. The prize discovery was a villa owned by a wealthy noble. It was about 3 stories facing the sea, and within that villa, the real prize was a trove of hundreds of books. Books, in a sense, they were scrolls of papyrus, about 1,800 of them, and the volcanic eruption had carbonized them, essentially preserving them. They looked like carbonized tree branches or oblong hockey pucks, and at first no one was quite sure what they were, so some of them were burned for fuel. Then it became clear these were scrolls. They might very well contain the lost works of some of the great thinkers of the ancient world. After all, Epicurus is celebrated even today, but his original works have never been found. What about Aeschylus? What classic works of drama or philosophy or history could be waiting for us, preserved in this villa? And of course, you can't just open these things up. They fall apart, they crack to dust. So Italians tried a number of approaches in the 1700s. Chemicals, liquid mercury, even sawing through them with a knife, kind of hoping some of the pages would still be legible. Scroll after scroll was destroyed, and then a man invented a device to painstakingly unspool the scrolls millimeters in a single day. It would take years, but there was some success with the Piaggio machine. So what was in the scrolls? Most of what we've been able to decipher comes from an admirer of Epicurus, an Epicurean named Philodemus. But there's a lot more we haven't seen yet. And people started to even trade the scrolls as currency for a time. One famous story, who knows if true, includes the trade of 18 scrolls for 18 kangaroos. Today, some very creative thinkers are using new technology to peer inside the carbonized scrolls. What if we don't have to open them up? What if we can use imaging to see inside without risking the health of the books? And this effort goes beyond Herculaneum. The Dead Sea Scrolls, En-Gedi, other ancient books, the possibilities are remarkable. Today, one of the leading minds in this field is visiting RIT. Brent Seals is giving a presentation at RIT, and as you can see, I'm sort of excited that he is here on Connection. So I will welcome him first. Brent Seals is a professor and chair of the Department of Computer Science and director of the Center for Visualization and Virtual Environments at the University of Kentucky. Brent, welcome to the program. Great to have you.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Roger Easton's here. Roger's a professor of imaging science and director of the Laboratory for Imaging of Historical Artifacts at RIT. Roger, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And Greg Hayworth is an associate professor of English and textual science and director of the Lazarus Project at the University of Rochester. Greg, welcome to you as well.
Great to be here.
Well, I promise, Brent, we're not just going to talk Herculaneum. In fact, there are some great success stories, there's a wide range we're going to cover today. But I do want to just ask you briefly about whether we can have more hope today. I heard Brent's name for the first time in a New Yorker article, I think it was November of 2015, and it was a deep dive into what technology was telling us about these Herculaneum scrolls, but it did not end with a lot of optimism. The ending note, Brent, was essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, this could happen, we could get word by word, letter by letter, but not in a human lifetime, you know, many, many, many years if we're ever going to get this done. Are we more optimistic today?
Well, I'd love for all your readers to go ahead and read that article because I think it's really well written. But maybe, I am from New York, actually. I grew up near Buffalo. Maybe because winter was coming on, the author was a little bit more pessimistic than I would be right now. With spring coming on, I actually think we're perched on the edge of being able to solve this problem, absolutely.
All right, we're going to talk about how that can happen. You should know that Brent is giving a talk at RIT called Digital Unwrapping: Homer, Herculaneum, and the Scroll from En-Gedi. That's at 7 o'clock in Ingle Auditorium in the Student Alumni Union. It is free and open to the public, 7 p.m. tonight. I think it's just a great opportunity to learn from one of the leading minds. Roger, what's most exciting to you about this kind of a conversation?
Well, certainly Greg and I have been involved in doing this kind of work, but using different modalities. We typically use stuff that's more familiar to people, regular kind of imaging under different colors of light, trying to find different combinations of those to read it. And we've had very good luck with the Archimedes palimpsest, the Martellus map, a couple of globes we've worked on. Greg, you can probably remember more than I can. We've been working on this for a number of years now.
Go ahead, Greg. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, both ancient and modern manuscripts. In fact, modern manuscripts, strangely, are often more fragile than the ancient counterparts. So there's a lot of cultural heritage to be recovered, and these various kinds of modalities really are stand poised to change the future of the past.
And when you talk about why the more modern manuscripts are more fragile, why would that be?
Well, it depends on what they're written on. So, for example, parchment is animal skin. It's very, very robust. And the inks are very, they sink into the parchment. Even when they're erased, we can recover them. Less so with papyrus.
Okay, and papyrus is what we're dealing with from Herculaneum. What about En Gedi? What's the material there?
The material there is animal skin. It's a little bit thicker, so that when you see it in the X-ray, you have a little bit more chance to, find the layers, follow the layers. And the inks are a little bit different. Basically, you have a range of all this material that has writing, and everything that you find is different.
I want to start, before we dive into the science here, I want to tell you, first of all, I think Megan Mack took a picture. Did we post the picture? So if you jump on Twitter, mmacmedia is Megan Mack. I'm at Evan Dawson. We'll post a picture that Brent brought. I guess it's a model of a scroll from En Gedi and a scroll from Herculaneum, what they would look like. So you can see that. We're also going to post the New Yorker article that Brent mentioned. It really is a great read. It reads just like great drama, and it's a lot of fun, but it's really educational. So our Twitter accounts will have that. I want to ask all three of our guests, though, a broad question, and it may seem, sort of hokey, but I care about this because I am fascinated by these ancient voices, how much wisdom that there is, what we might find that is lost. Think about all the great writers and thinkers, historians like Livy, but also Aeschylus and many others, who we know there's more work out there somewhere, or maybe it's all lost, but what if we could find it again? This is a view into the ancient world that this writing could bring us. And I don't know how you even put a price or a value on that. That's why it matters to me. Brent, for you, why does this work matter so much?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's the same. It's the human condition. This is a direct message from the mind of the ancient world to our minds. Each one of these writings is like a time capsule. And, writing itself is only 4,000 or 5,000 years old. So we're going back half that distance right in time and providing this keyhole with technology to be able to read these things. I think it's invaluable.
Yeah, Roger, what do you think?
Absolutely. It's one of the interesting things to me is the fact that we have such complementary technologies that are able to do different things, and we need them all. We have a large amount of work ahead of us, and we need a lot more effort put into it.
Greg?
It's not only just recovering the text, it's also recovering versions of texts. What's interesting is to see how a work evolves over time, the changes of mind that an author or scribes may have worked on a text. And one of the things that we can do is see back in time to these earlier versions of a text that we know very well.
So we're going to talk about these, different sources and different material. I started with Herculaneum, so let me ask Brent there. What do we know so far about what these scrolls actually were? I mentioned Philodemus, kind of a disciple of Epicurus, but what have we seen? What's the best that we've seen so far from them?
Well, so as a computer scientist, I'm less an expert on the history, right?
Okay.
More on the technology. Greg would probably know more about, the significance of the texts that have been opened than
okay.
I would.
Greg?
Well, the Epicurean tradition is one which has come down to us in a kind of prejudicial form through the Middle Ages. The Stoics were hostile to the Epicureans. And so what we're learning about true Epicureanism, the school of Epicurus, is quite different from what we've known in the past. And we have partial texts of Philodemus, and some of them are very, very important. And Brent's, filling in those holes.
Can I just ask you, when you say the Stoics were sort of prejudiced against Epicureanism, tell me if I would get a passing grade if this my answer on one of your tests, Professor. Is it because the Stoics viewed Epicureans as almost hedonists, as sort of out of control, disrespectful, whereas Epicurus, his first, one of the first ideas that I pick up in reading about Epicurus is just the absence of pain, not even necessarily pleasure, yes, but also the absence of pain for as many people as possible. So it's not necessarily wild, drunken parties all the time. In fact, I'm not even sure if Epicurus was celibate himself. I mean, it's just, it's an interesting question when you think about the context. Is that what we're talking about with that bias?
Precisely. It's precisely that. The idea of pleasure shades easily into happiness as well. So I think, the Stoics and If you think of the Stoics as the Puritans of the ancient world, then no one wants to be happy if you're a Puritan. But Epicurus accepted happiness and pleasure as an important, essential quality of the human condition.
Okay, so this work really matters for a wide range of reasons. And with Herculaneum, Brent, take us back a little bit here when you first encountered the possibility of getting involved in work like this.
In the late 90s, we were talking about digital libraries. And the first part of building a digital library is to make something digital. And at that point, I realized that there were some materials that are very hard to digitize. They're just too badly damaged. You can't see anything when you make them digital. What do you do about those parts of the library? So that was the beginning for me of being interested in damaged materials.
Did you then say, what's the hardest problem in the whole world I could tackle? I'm going to...
No, I didn't do that, actually. Unfortunately, I fell into one of the hardest problems by accident, but we were working at the time on the Beowulf manuscript to start with, and then other manuscripts in that collection at the British Library, the Cotton Collection, that were also similarly damaged, and we were trying to see if we could use technology to reverse some of that. And so then there was this progression over time that eventually in 2004 landed me with... the problem of the scroll, which cannot be opened at all. And that became very intriguing for me. And Herculaneum is front and center in that space.
When you think about Herculaneum scrolls, I found it amazing, and again, please correct any errors here, in reading about the history of trying to open these things up. You know, they find evidence of this villa in the 1700s. They try these terrible techniques that just were not working. And then you get the Piaggio machine. I mean... You know, when I've seen what it might have looked like, it's a bizarre effort to take, you know, this very brittle parchment and just very painstakingly slowly open it up. And it kind of worked a little bit, Brent?
It did kind of work. And it was painstaking. I mean, they were talking about millimeters a day or less, you know, unwrapping over the course of years. And only the best conditioned scrolls mm-hmm. really had a shot. So that still left behind hundreds of scrolls that could never be opened, even with that machine.
The best conditioned scrolls from Herculaneum compare to the worst in what way? I mean, what hope do we have for the best conditioned
ones? Well, the best ones weren't crushed lengthwise. So if you imagine scrunching them end to end, like if you held them between your hands and pushed, that creates wrinkles that make it really hard to unroll in the direction of the papyrus. And those were the worst. So there were some that didn't have that, and so they could be opened a little bit more readily. But, you know, even so, carbonization, it's a disaster.
Okay. When it comes then to trying to see inside them without even having to open them then, what's the technology like now? What direction is that going? And you know, tell me why you're an optimist.
Well, tomography actually won the Nobel Prize, right? The guys who invented it in 1979. And it's transformed medicine to be able to see inside the human body non-invasively. So the application of tomography, which is based on X-ray, to other materials has been systematically happening over the last 20 years. The reason why I'm optimistic is because that's becoming mature as computation has also come along. So we have the computational ability to do some amazing things. Together with that kind of scanning technique, you can see inside, and then you can process all of that data in amazing ways.
It sounds like it's no big deal, but it's not a fast process, is it?
No, it's not fast, and it is a big deal. I'm optimistic because we have had a success this past year in completely virtually unwrapping an unknown text and revealing it to the scholarly world at a level that was good enough to be able to do pure scholarship.
Okay, and so what have we gained in the years of understanding Herculaneum before we had this technology? I mean, how much progress have we seen on individual scrolls?
There's been an acceleration in the last 20 years, starting with the kind of imaging that my colleagues do, spectral imaging on the things that have already been opened. There were breakthroughs earlier on being able to do that so that you can see the ink better so the scholarship could progress. Starting in the mid-2000s with my work, we see this non-invasive, complete unwrapping. So, you know, if you look at the timeline, we're talking about 2,000 years, the last 20. It's not a big portion of that, right?
Yeah.
So I'm optimistic that, you know, another decade, maybe another year, we're going to be there.
Wow. And Greg, is it wise or unwise for us to have hopes for what the scrolls might contain? In other words, you know, it would be understandable for us to hope that some of the lost works of history are actually sitting in that library and maybe sitting in that, for lack of a better word, the pile of scrolls that we haven't opened yet. does that confirmation bias lead us to do things we shouldn't do, or do you have hopes for what we might find there?
Of course I have hopes. I mean, what I'd love to be able to find is some kind of catalog so that we actually know what texts exist. That would enable us to look not just here but elsewhere and to know what we're seeing when we see a portion of a fragment. The wealth of this particular trove is such that there's no question that we're going to be adding to the canon, significantly adding to the canon. The things that Brent's going to be helping scholars to pull out are going to be on the syllabus in the next generation.
That's remarkable. And do you have any, is there a best case scenario for you about what comes out of what's left?
Well, I have my own personal hope.
Sure.
I would love to see Aristotle's Comedy, but lots of people would, but don't hold out much hope. But there,
it's not impossible, though, I guess. And would that be one of the really great discoveries scientifically? Thinking about how lost that is, lost to history, we know it exists somewhere.
Yes, I mean,
how do you compare it?
It's in literature, it's enormous. But I have to say, we've already had one of those discoveries. And my colleague Roger Easton was center in recovering lost texts by Archimedes, the greatest classical mathematician.
So how did that happen?
How far back do you want me to go?
No, we've got time. Go ahead, tell the story.
My colleague of Greg and I and Brent, Keith Knox, and I started working on this back in the mid-90s. And we were very lucky to get a lead onto working on this Archimedes palimpsest, which was a 10th century manuscript erased and overwritten in 1229. And the original writings was the oldest known copy of the works of Archimedes. And it was going up for sale at auction by Christie's. And the woman, Hope Mayo, who was writing the auction catalog, happened to be at Christie's in London saying, I need somebody to take pictures of this book, and I don't know anybody to do it. And she happened to be talking to Keith Knox's sister-in-law, who works at Christie's. And she says, call my brother-in-law in Rochester. So Hope Mayo flew up here on U.S. Air Express with this $800,000 book in her backpack. And we spent a day imaging it in 1998, and it went up for sale at auction. And then we had the opportunity to image the entire thing after it was sold for $2 million instead of the $800,000 that had been predicted. And so we worked on that from 2000 through 2011. It took that long to get the book conserved and get the pages separated so we could actually image them.
I assume you weren't the $2 million bidder.
That's correct.
Okay, so you still had to get access to it. And part of what I read through about Brent's work with Herculaneum and the question on 1,800 scrolls, but some of them I think are in different places or different under different authority.
That's absolutely correct.
You still had the access even after somebody paid $2 million.
Well, it was a private owner. Okay. So once we had convinced the owner, it was significantly easier to get access. But certainly we have had much more difficulty. In fact, Greg and I are getting on a plane on Thursday to go to the Museum of the Bible in Oklahoma City to image an important erased manuscript there.
What's the manuscript?
It's the St. John Climaci palimpsest. Actually, Greg again is probably more equipped to address that than I am. But it's a very important manuscript that from St. Catherine's Monastery in Sinai that was erased and overwritten.
Actually, we're going to be doing that in the summer, and we're going to be doing the oldest Hebrew prayer book.
The oldest Hebrew prayer book. Wow.
Yes, which is also palimpsested.
And again, goes back how long?
I'm not sure the date. I'm not sure if they know exactly the date, but it is, I think, around the 9th century.
Around the 9th century. Can you define, for listeners who haven't heard the term palimpsest used often, go ahead, a brief explanation?
Well, a palimpsest is a reused parchment. So a parchment that had been written on, and it's been scraped, the original writing has been scraped off. Often it's rotated, and then it's reinscribed. And that can happen more than once. You can have a multiple palimpsest.
Before the printing press, they had to come up with lots of clever ways of writing and transcribing. And so, okay, but let me go back to Archimedes, by the way. How significant historically is the work that was done with this?
It's absolutely fundamental. Two new texts of Archimedes, which Roger can tell you about and their importance.
The Method of Mechanical Theorems, which was a letter from Archimedes to Eratosthenes describing how Archimedes used mechanical analogies to prove mathematical theorems. And that had only been known in reference. It had never been seen in by the Modern World, and that is in that book. And there's also another important text, the so-called Stomachion, for stomach ache, which was where the first study in combinatorics.
And basically, you know, it shows that Archimedes is using a form of calculus 2,000 years before
Newton and Leibniz.
That's amazing. That is really remarkable. Do you have a sense for the history as you're doing this kind of work?
You certainly develop it. And that for me, that's amongst the most interesting, the most pleasurable parts, is getting that sense of the history. And it's also meeting the people who are crucially interested in being able to read these documents, because over the years I've become quite familiar with several of them, and they literally will call me up and say, can you work on this particular section right now?
Roger, you began that work in 1998, you said, right?
1998 was when we worked on the Archimedes. Okay. We actually had done some work on Dead Sea Scrolls prior to that.
But look at 1998 versus now. How has the technology changed?
Night and day. The camera that we used to do the early work on the Archimedes was 1.5 megapixel. It was a Kodak sensor. And then the camera we use now is 50 megapixel.
And yes.
So it's a significant change. And our lighting has changed. We now use light-emitting diodes, which are far less potential for damage to the manuscript. We take many, many more wavelengths than we used to take. We do stuff in fluorescence, which we didn't do originally. There's just a variety of changes.
Okay. And this is a question that may be best suited for Brent, but I think when we talk about the different materials from papyrus, animal skin, parchment, to the different kinds of inks, I believe that I've read that there's an advantage when the ink is a little raised on the surface and easier to detect through different imaging, or is that not correct? Bren?
Those things can all help.
Okay.
Basically, you're looking for any kind of advantage with the technology to be able to see ink, especially if you're trying to distinguish it from a black or a carbonized background.
Okay. Roger?
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah, any difference in the texture, the quality of the ink surface compared to the parchment is something we can utilize.
Okay. In our second half hour, we're going to talk about En-Gedi. We're going to talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. We'll talk a little bit more about what's coming up tonight at 7 p.m. Brent's in town for a talk at RIT called Digital Unwrapping, Homer, Herculaneum, and the Scroll from En-Gedi. That's at 7 p.m. tonight in Ingle Auditorium, free and open to the public. That's at RIT. But have a question. From a couple of questions via email. Mark just says, Evan, if I've read correctly, there are a lot more scrolls coming from the Villa of the Papyri that's at Herculaneum because they haven't excavated the entire villa. Can your guest talk about that?
It's true that it's thought there may be more unexcavated scrolls. It's really not known if that's true, though, and currently excavations are halted.
From what I have read, and again, you guys can jump in and help me with this, part of the concern is that what has already been excavated, they could use a little bit more funding and upkeep for that property, and that there's concern about excavating more on this three-story seaside villa, considering when you look at what's already been excavated. Is that roughly true or not true?
That is true, and okay. They also have a modern site that's over the top, so you have modern concerns as well as the preservation of the ancient site.
It's kind of sad to hear that, though, that you know you've excavated part of this villa, this amazing historical find, and that the upkeep could be better. I mean, I'm a little disappointed to hear that, I guess.
Well, that is disappointing, but, you know, on the optimistic side, if we can solve the technical problems of being able to read these, then there's going to be a lot more interest in finding the funding and going after each one of these, which would be a time capsule and a completely new manuscript, right?
Is there a reason to think, Greg, that there's an entire library that the 1,800 scrolls we have from Herculaneum is actually just the tip of the iceberg and that there may be many more scrolls?
We have no idea. I mean, until the excavation's done, it's simply guesswork.
Possible?
Well, yeah, anything's possible. We certainly hope that.
When you think about those moments of, I guess, over 24, 48 hours of people fleeing, trying to escape after Vesuvius blows, is there reason to think that they were trying to preserve or take some of the scrolls with them? I don't know exactly where they were found in the villa, but those would have been important objects at the time, would they not?
Sure. My assumption from having seen the preserved bodies is that most of them were trying to save themselves.
Yeah. Well, and I don't mean to laugh. It's just an amazing historical preservation. So if you're just joining us, we're talking about imaging science and historical documents. Brent Seals is here. He's a professor and chair of the Department of Computer Science and director of the Center for Visualization and Virtual Environments at the University of Kentucky. Roger Easton is a professor of imaging science and director of the Laboratory for Imaging of Historical Artifacts at RIT. And Greg Hayworth, associate professor of English and textual science and director of the Lazarus Project at the University of Rochester, which needs its own definition, by the way. What's the Lazarus Project?
The Lazarus Project is a not-for-profit initiative to recover damaged cultural heritage using a variety of imaging technologies around the world for free.
It was in 2015 that Brent and his research team identified the oldest known copy of the Book of Leviticus other than the Dead Sea Scrolls, carbon dated to the 3rd century CE. Is that right? Let's get our only break, come back, talk a lot more about that here, and answer any questions you have as well as we continue our discussion on imaging science and historical documents. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, we sit down with Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. There's a lot to talk about, from recent commentary on crime statistics, policing, economic development, and more. Mayor Warren in our first hour. Then in our second hour, we're talking about International Women's Day, particularly through the lens of African-American women who often don't enjoy the benefits of progress. Talk to you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In 2015, Brent Seals and his research team identified the oldest known copy of the Book of Leviticus, carbon dated to the 3rd century CE, though the dating is in question. We're going to talk about that in just a second. A little bit of background here that, again, I would love our guest to correct if we get anything wrong here, but just a little background. That text was recovered from the charred and unrolled En Gedi scroll discovered at the site of an ancient synagogue in Israel in about 1970. And the scroll was essentially a lump of charcoal. We have a picture that Brent brought along, a model. So if you see the picture on Twitter of the bigger lump and the smaller lump, it's the smaller lump. That's En Gedi. It was so delicate that when touched, pieces would flake off. So you can't just unwrap it. You could destroy it forever if you did that. So Seals and his team used, well, some specialized imaging. So we're going to talk about that. Brent, how did this one get on your radar? Tell me about sort of the history of getting to work on this one.
We'd been working on Herculaneum for a while, and there were technical papers in the literature. And so when the New Yorker article came out, which I hope your listeners will go read, it gave us some momentum. And that was what attracted the interest of the Israel Antiquities Authority, because they had this little fragment and they thought it might be valuable. And they just wondered, well, might this technology work for our fragment as well?
Have they had it since 1970?
They have. It was excavated in 1970 and then put in the archives since then, with really sort of an unknown disposition because it's so damaged.
Yeah, I'm almost amazed that they could recover something like that in 1970 and hold it for decades without really further damaging. I mean, I guess time is always doing some kind of damage, but what's the worst or what's the best you can do to preserve this kind of material without further damaging it?
Well, of course, they're experts there at managing the antiquities that are constantly coming from the archaeological sites in Israel, and they manage also the Dead Sea Scrolls themselves. Mm-hmm. So they know exactly how to preserve these kinds of items. I think what's really interesting is that it came forward at the right time for us to be able to work on it.
Sure. They called you after the New Yorker article.
They did, yeah. They not only called me, but actually had it scanned and provided the data to me. So I didn't even see the actual object until after we had done our analysis.
Wow. Okay. And what did we find from it?
Well, we found a complete text within the wraps of the scroll, and it turned out to be an early copy of Leviticus, which is a Torah scroll. It makes it a Torah scroll.
Amazing. And you said that the dating, technically carbon dating to 3rd century CE, but there's some question?
Because we were able to pull a high enough quality image of the text to allow handwriting analysis, the expert handwriting analysis tells us that it might actually be an earlier scroll than the carbon dating. The carbon dating always gives you a probability, and so you estimate the center of that probability as the date. So actually, the carbon dating could allow an earlier date, as early as 1st century. The handwriting actually indicates probably an earlier date. So it's interesting to see the tension between those.
And for your work, I mean, the condition very different in Gedi versus Herculaneum?
Well, the condition, both of them are very badly damaged. We were ready for, our software had become more mature because of it being hammered by Herculaneum. And that really helped us do the complete analysis when En Gedi became available.
Was there any single aha moment or you know, any great pleasurable opportunity for you to say, look, this is going to work. We've got to, this is amazing what we're going to be able to do with this.
There was. I mean, as you can imagine, these things don't all happen at the same time and immediately. But there was a moment when I and my staff and my students realized that we were seeing writing and that we were going to have the capability to completely extract all the writing. The writing was seen as being very systematic. Now, we can't read Hebrew, right? So we didn't really know at that point what the text was, but we knew that it was writing and that we were going to be able to extract it. And that moment was really exciting.
It's also, I think, important to point out that even to the extent that we can get letters and words and text, from what I've read, again, please jump in to help with this. These scrolls were not written, you know, sort of line by line with periods and sentences exactly as modern writing, that in different places, different styles and systems were used, and that it takes some really talented and learned people to understand what we're seeing. Right, Brent?
There are experts in these areas, and I hadn't known who they were for this mm-hmm. scroll, but we were able to collaborate with two scholars from Hebrew University, Emmanuel Tov and Michael Siegel, and they are experts indeed. I mean, they were able instantly to be able to place what this text was and to be able to understand it and start interpreting it.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
Can you comment on that as well?
Many of the early writing systems, you know, there isn't a system of punctuation. And if you can imagine reading your favorite novel without any punctuation, it leaves a lot to be, a lot for you to figure out. But more than that, sometimes there aren't any spaces between words. The scriptura continua is, a steady stream of letters. And so you have to know the language so well and the grammar so well that you can separate these words.
And there have been some errors over time in some interpretation, yes?
Sure. There are errors now in all kinds of texts that we have. That's why we have editors. They give their best guess, and they use a variety of manuscripts, and they kind of triangulate on what they think is the best reading. But yeah, they're giving their best guess.
Roger, what do you think?
Well, one of the manuscripts that we've been working on, things like very small accents make a lot of difference. And the scholar will come back and say, can we check to see if there's an accent over this one character? And, well, I've already given you everything I can. But so we just have to keep trying different things until we can make it completely distinguishable.
Christy writes to the program and says, can Dr. Seals describe the steps a document goes through to be virtually opened? And, Christy, it's a great question. Let's walk through that a little bit, especially with the host is going to add to Christy's question with my own ignorant question. So the scroll is obviously a wrap of text. So even when you start to get through and successfully see letters, words, et cetera, you know, is it a jumble or are you able to sort of distinguish page by page without opening? What's the challenge there? So why don't you work through Christy's question and then kind of explain how that happens?
Sure, that's a great question. Yeah, actually, with the scanning alone, you end up with something that looks like a word salad. You know, it's just a floating bunch of letters from an alphabet that you might not even recognize. So it's all of the steps that follow that helps you completely disassemble what looks like this jumble and end up with something that makes sense. So we're imposing this structure through pieces of software. And the first step in doing that is finding the layer that the writing is actually on. Because if you don't find the layer, then you have no way to order the way the text is actually flowing inside that structure. So we call that segmentation. We find those layers, very similar to finding every page in a book. And you realize that if you cross pages, then when you read what comes out, it's not going to be right. You'll have some text from one page and some from another.
Okay. And which I'm sure it happens. But again, how do you have confidence that, you know, the ordering, for lack of a term, is correct?
We can see the structure in the scan, and we can know that we've followed every layer correctly by going back and just verifying. It's not really an automated process completely, so we have humans in the loop who can verify that we're doing it correctly. But even after finding that structure, everything is still in three dimensions, right? It's all wrapped up, and that means you still can't really read what's there. So we have to do this unwrapping part. That's why we call it virtual unwrapping, because it's all digital, but it involves this step of taking that wrapped up three-dimensional thing, like a jelly roll, right, or a potato chip that's crinkled, and then flattening that out. And we do that in software as well.
Okay. And are we seeing, is it as good as it's going to get? Is it getting better?
oh, it's getting better, and much of it can be automated. And, you know, the more experience that we have using this software on more objects, the better that we'll get. We're actually hoping that we can release the software to the scholarly community and continue to build momentum around people who want to use this to reveal the invisible library.
I want to know what the reaction to En-Gedi was. This work that you did, you know, the Christianity Today magazine called it the most significant discovery in biblical archaeology of 2015. What was some of the other reaction you got to that work?
Well, let me tell you, first of all, my reaction. We sent off what we had discovered as writing in draft form to Penina Shore, who is the director of the Israel Antiquities Authority Dead Sea Scroll Project. And it was her response that was really the aha moment, because she was the one who identified the text and told us that it was a huge discovery. So, I mean, her reaction first was incredibly inspirational. But after that, I think people are really fascinated with the fact that the technology can do this, right? And that there is discovery possible. Most people think of discovery as coming only from archaeology, right? As opposed to wringing more out of what we already have in libraries and museums.
Okay. And what happens for you next then, Brent? What are the big projects that you're working on? Obviously, Herculaneum is ongoing, but what are the big projects you're working on now?
Well, let me say it's great to be here with my colleagues, to be invited to give this talk tonight, because collaboration is where this field advances, right? And so being able to answer that is really all about, you know, where do we have access? Where will we be able to apply this technology? There's sites all over the world, St. Catherine's Monastery in Egypt, places in Europe, even places right here in America. For example, the Gilchrist Museum out in Oklahoma has Native American material that is also really interesting. So, you know, there are a number of places where this technology and the technology that my colleagues run, where that can really have an incredible impact.
Is it competitive or is it more collaborative?
For my part, it's collaborative. Science is always walking the line between competitive and collaborative, but we're talking about things here that span enormous timescales, right? So what's at stake is more than just, you know, someone's sort of immediate discovery, but we're talking about things that are 2,000 and 3,000 years old. So I say it's collaborative.
And you're still a relatively young guy here. Do you think by the end of your career or the end of your lifetime, we're going to be talking about knowing the full breadth of Herculaneum?
Yeah, I believe so. And I plan to live a long time, so I'm giving myself some
That's
some,
good. That's
slack
good.
There. Yeah.
I'm a big fan of living a long time. But you really believe that?
I do, yeah. I think that technology is accelerating at rates we can't even imagine.
Roger, you think so?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and again, just to echo what Brent said, it is very much the complementarity of the technologies that allows us to work together and collaborate, because the stuff that Brent does is can relate to the stuff that we do, but it is enough different that it applies in different situations.
Yeah. Greg, are you
confident? Yeah, I mean, following on that, you know, we, Brent, Roger, and I worked together for the first time a couple of years ago now. We were working on the damaged collection of the museum of, or the Cathedral Library of Chartres in France. It bombed in World War II. We'd been working on some of the charred texts that could be opened, but what we couldn't do was we had no way to image these carbonized manuscripts, which looked like, you know, enormous blackened bricks. And so we called Brent, and you know, Brent came out, and we were able to, you know, use tomography on those and you know, start the process of unwrapping those texts as well.
The results are dazzling.
And you've mentioned what's going on in St. Catherine's Monastery. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's happening there?
I was involved in a project there with a number of colleagues to try to image the palimpsests in their so-called new finds, a collection that was discovered in the 70s. And we were supposed to image the entire set of palimpsests from that, but we kept discovering more and more in the collection. So we didn't quite get it done, but we imaged something of the order of 75 of the 160, and that took 5 years to do. So we were hoping to go back and do the entire collection there. And that would involve a number of colleagues as well.
Is there a single most significant discovery there so far?
Oh, gee. The one, I can tell you the one that I'm most fascinated by, which is the manuscript that's written in Caucasian Albanian, which is a completely dead language. And Greg and I were in Tbilisi 2 years ago with a scholar who was trying to read it, and it only worked in transmission. You can only see it in light through the page itself. And he says, oh, there's the Caucasian Albanian word for fish. I didn't know that before.
Wait a second. It's a dead language. How does he know that?
Only three, as I understand it, three scholars in the world study it. And it's only been known because it was discovered at St. Catherine's. They know that the manuscript, this particular manuscript, was the Gospel of John, which was allowed in, what allowed him to figure out what the words were.
Ah. But it was Greg, you're nodding there. That's a
yeah. I mean, the question is, you know, how do you know what an old language is if you've never seen the word before? And that's you have to know that you're working on a particular kind of text, so you expect something.
All right. Well, I've got a little time left in the hour, and so what I want to do is I'd love to start with Greg on this, because I love talking about, you know, sort of understanding ancient books. One of my favorite books was The Swerve, and understanding this hunt for these connective tissues to our human past. And I'm wondering if you think that we are not teaching the classics, the ancient texts, enough for what we already have, let alone what we haven't yet discovered, Greg.
I mean, we think of the canon as a coffin. That everything
as a coffin?
As a coffin. Everything that has been written is known. That's our assumption, that it can never change, that it's not living. And in fact, that's not true. Some of my basic calculations about the existence of manuscripts in pre-1500 in Europe alone is that we have at least 60,000 manuscripts, which can in part be recovered, in part, perhaps entirely, and that we simply don't know it. What they contain. So the potential for changing that canon radically is something that we've already done. Brent's done it, Roger's done it, and I've done it. And I think that we're going to be teaching these texts. It is an extremely exciting time. It's the equivalent of, Petrarch, 14th century, when suddenly new texts by Cicero start appearing, or, the 15th century, when suddenly we get from Constantinople a bunch of new Greek texts. This is what we're experiencing now. It's a new renaissance.
Yeah, I think in the book The Swerve, it had this theory that Poggio Broccolini's discovery of On the Nature of Things by Lucretius helped spark the Renaissance itself. That one lost text rediscovered helped spark a new way of thinking, new artistic revolution, revolution in literature, and some of the critics have said, well, that could be overblown, but certainly this discovery was huge in the 15th century. Is it possible that we would ever see something like that again, Greg, or is that hoping too much?
Absolutely.
You really believe that?
Absolutely. Last year, I was working on the oldest manuscript of Welsh, which has it's called the Black Book of Carmarthen, held at the National Library of Wales. And it's a beautiful 12th century manuscript. And we imaged it, and we suddenly discovered new Welsh poetry in it that had been hidden and overwritten, which fundamentally changes. It dealt with King Arthur. It fundamentally changes some of the mythos, basic mythos upon which English and Welsh culture is based. So yeah, these things happen all the time. We've imaged the oldest book of English, the Vercelli book, and are still pulling things out of that. The oldest translation of the Gospels into Latin, the Codex Recollensis, and have gotten great results there. And this is just the beginning. The problem here, fundamentally, is not one of research. It's not one of technology. It's one of curriculum. And one of the things that I think all three of us here are interested in doing is teaching these techniques, which are interdisciplinary, really radically interdisciplinary between the sciences and the humanities, teaching a new generation of students who can go out and continue this work in a time in which so many of these manuscripts are in jeopardy, both from a war and terrorism and global warming.
Do we have interest from students to continue the work?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and that's one of the reasons that we're creating this new field that I call textual science, so that once you name it, then you can actually bring people together. And so Roger and I have developed Archive in Rochester to do just that, to be a kind of genius bar for cultural heritage imaging projects and training students in just these techniques.
Do you often have students, do you have to pull them into this kind of discipline? Or do they go to school seeking this out? Obscure is not the right word, but it's emerging. How do you pull students in this direction?
there's a certain kind of student who gets a little bit of dust of antiquity in his nose, and there's nothing like it. Opening a book, reading a text for the first time that no one has read in 1,000, 2,000 years, there's nothing like that.
And plus, it's bursting the silos, the silos of the humanities and the sciences. You know, they wouldn't even talk to each other. They didn't even know the same language. And now we're able to do that. I think it's of interest to students in both general areas.
We actually just had a conversation on this program with the Secretary of the Smithsonian, who was in Rochester last week, talking about the importance of not just separating STEM versus arts and humanities. Another good example here, Roger?
Absolutely.
It ties into that very well? Okay. Go ahead, Brent. You want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, the invisible library, right? I mean, it is going to change the canon, and it's going to change this younger generation's idea about where technology fits in their worldview. I mean, they might not even realize it, but it's the tech that's fueling this renaissance. It's a digital renaissance is essentially what it is. And they're going to be the ones in charge of that.
An email from a listener named Allison who just wants to know, what's the difference between looking at scrolls that were buried in lava, I don't know if is lava the right term, or scrolls that were burned in a fire?
There is a little bit of a difference. The pyroclastic flow is really what it is that preserved the Herculaneum scrolls and made them carbonized. That kind of penetrates all the way to the core of every one of those scrolls because there was heat but no oxygen, so they don't burn. They didn't burn. Fire, on the other hand, kind of goes from the outside in, so as you do the analysis, you see profound damage on the outside and actual readable stuff on the inside, so it's more non-uniform.
Go ahead, Greg.
It's interesting that you mentioned this because Brent and I are interested in doing a project in California at the Huntington Library with that concerns a manuscript of Jack London's Seawolf, which had been placed in the only manuscript had been placed in a metal box, and in 1906 the building was burned down along with much of the city. And it carbonized the manuscript inside, and it's stayed in that box since. And we're trying to now create a project in which Brent can use his techniques to image that text, but we have to get out of the box first. So it's a thinking outside the box problem.
You have to realize how irresistible this is too, because even when you were a kid, I'm sure that you did invisible ink, right? I mean, we all did.
Yes.
You write something in lemon juice, right? And then you try to figure out how to make it visible. That's exactly what we're doing here, right? It's the invisible library, and we're making it visible.
That's why we need to do science experiments like this early on. We can't lose touch with this because who knows what kind of career it could lead to down the line. By the way, what is the Jack London? What's the...
The Seawolf. I mean, we have the text, but the manuscript, the first draft of it, that's what we'd love to have.
Okay. And I know some listeners hear that and they think, okay, but you already have the text. What's the big deal?
Well, this goes back to what I was saying before. Every manuscript evolves. And it's fascinating to see what he's eliminated, what passages didn't make the cut.
It's a window into the mind of a great writer, right?
Exactly. And a window into the mind at a particular time. You're looking back in time at the changes of mind that he had on the page.
All right. And that also kind of directs me thinking about how we have ancient writers' works, because over time, if I'm remembering correctly from The Swerve and other sources, you know, occasionally text would be recopied, you know, every, what, few hundred years, sometimes they'd be recopied. And could there be, Greg, people who are doing the copying who wanted to editorialize a little or change some of that work?
Absolutely. It's not that they intend to change. It's just that, kind of like playing telephone, you repeat something again and again, and things necessarily change. Sometimes scribes didn't know the language. Sometimes they'd speak a different dialect, and because spelling wasn't standardized, they would hear homophones and they'd write what they thought they were reading.
And so when it comes to Herculaneum, for example, we have a lot of Philodemus's work. Was that his own? I have no idea. Super ignorant question here. Is that his own work and his own writing that we know of, or is it not? Is that considered copies?
Is your question whether it's a holograph copy? A holograph would be written in by Philodemus himself.
Yes.
I assume not.
Okay.
It's usually, and this is true of Plato and Aristotle as well, it's usually, you know, they didn't write things down. It's usually their students who took notes. So these are probably notes that were taken by the students in his school.
And the term you just used, holograph copy,
mm-hmm.
which means original work in the author's original hand?
By the original author in his own hand, yeah.
How we don't have too much of that, do we?
There are some famous texts. I mean, Petrarch's Canzoniere are written. There's a copy in the Vatican in his own hand. There are other manuscripts like that, not just literature, but also music, for example.
I just find all of your work so interesting. And Brent, why don't you let our listeners know again, 7 o'clock tonight, what you're going to be focusing on tonight at RIT?
I'm going to give a retrospective because I'd like the listeners to be able to hear a little bit about how this work has evolved and what goes into being able to have a discovery like we had this past year with the En Gedi scroll.
Okay, and the presentation is called Digital Unwrapping, Homer, Herculaneum, and the Scroll from En Gedi, 7 o'clock tonight in Ingle Auditorium in the Student Alumni Union. It is free and open to the public, so Brent will be there for that. And you got a taste of it here. They indulged so many of my questions, which I could not have enjoyed it more, and just appreciate all three of you for coming in and sharing that. And occasionally, especially with our guests locally, we should check in with some progress. So thank you so much, Greg. It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks
you so much. Roger?
Thank you.
Thank you. And Brent, it's great having you in Rochester. Keep up the great work, and thank you for being here.
Thanks so much.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, the engineer of this broadcast, Megan Max, the producer. Once again, if you want to check out the New Yorker article that Brent mentioned a couple of times there, we've put it up on our Twitter feeds, at Evan Dawson and MMAC Media, and you can get a look as well at a picture of some of the models of these old scrolls that Brent brought. Have a great afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported Public Radio.